Week we were discussing that Christ had suffered in the flesh for us, and because of that, there are certain ways in which we should live our lives. It talks a little bit about the judgment that's going to come, and then there were times in which the Christians at that time, first century, had lived under perhaps a more Gentile way, and they have now come to know a better way to live. And because of that, they now need to be putting those things off. And this morning we'll pick up, like I said, in verse 6, and we'll try to get through this chapter this morning. Before we do, let's begin in prayer. So last week, we ended up right about verse 6, and to start verse 6, because it starts with, for this reason, let's read a little bit of context as we get into verse 6. So if you start up in verse 4, in regard to these things, they think it's strange, and it was because these people were not participating in the things perhaps that they formerly did or their friends do. They think it's strange that you don't run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. They will give an account of him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this reason, the gospel was preached to those who are dead, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh, but live according to God in the Spirit. So my first question I'd ask is, who are those that are dead? And what type of death is Peter talking about? The gospel was preached to those who are dead. Are you someone going to the graveside and preaching to those people who are dead? Does it mean that? If it doesn't, what does it mean? Spiritually dead? Maybe. We're talking about a time of tribulation, right? Time of suffering, time in which Christians were put to death, right? Could there have been a time when a Christian had become to know the gospel, had lived faithfully, was persecuted, put to death, but they'll be judged according to men in the flesh, so the men judge them that they were Christians, they were being put to death because they were Christians, but they live now according to God and the Spirit. And I think part of the reason that we have Christians at this particular time concerned that people are dying before Jesus' return. We know that Paul had the same issues, that the Christians were concerned about their brothers who had already passed. Have they missed out on the rest that had been promised? And I think what Peter is also trying to tell them, that that's not the case, is that if they were put to death or if they have died, you're not going to preach to someone who's already dead. But if there are those who have died, they are now living according to God in the Spirit. So other ways to sort of look at that. I don't think it's telling them that we're preaching to people who are already dead. Imminent, it's coming now. Right.
You're not to, you know, the man's not going to work, you shall not eat. So
right.
It's not the only time that the subject of, you know, when is this return? And
right.
When is it going to take place?
Right. And we're going to get a little bit more even in that later in this chapter in terms of that idea of Christ's return. Any other thoughts or comments about those who are dead? Again, if you look at verse 5, they will give an account to him. So who are going to give that account? Who will give an account? Those who are speaking evil of you. We can see other scriptures that everyone will give an account what's been done in the body. But these people who are ridiculing, these people who are causing that tribulation, these people who are responsible for putting Christians to death at this particular time, they will give an account to him, meaning God, who is ready to judge the living and the dead. And so it's whether those people who have already passed or whether those people who are living when God comes, when Jesus returns, they will all give an account of what's been done in the body. Any other thoughts or comments about this section?
What jumps out to me, Stacy, is, you know, there for those who were persecuted to the point that they surrender their lives, I think there's this reinforcement of the idea that, you know,
And I think that same word of comfort, for even those who didn't take it unto death, we're going to see in verse 14 of this chapter, if you are reproached for the name of Christ. So those people who perhaps are just ridiculed for believing, he's going to tell them that, that's fine. I mean, we're telling you that that is going to happen, but you should take comfort in the fact that you are ridiculed in the name of Christ. And so this is on the other end of that, taking it all the way to the point of death. But it's something that you shouldn't be ashamed of, that you should be proud of the fact that you are suffering in the flesh as your Savior suffered in the flesh for you. But he reminds them here. He says, but then the end of all things is at hand. Therefore be serious and watchful in your prayers. And above all things, have fervent love for one another, for the love will cover a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without grumbling, as each one of you has received a gift. Minister to one another as good gifts, as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. If anyone speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. If anyone ministers, let him do it as if the ability which God supplies, that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. To him belong the glory and dominion forever and ever. So he starts off in verse 7 and says, but the end of all things is at hand. What end is at hand? And what does Scripture typically mean when that term is used? Do we see that in other places? How about James, the 5th chapter? Find it here a second. James, the 5th chapter, starting in verse 7, therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently, and for it receives the early and the latter rain. Yes, you also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. It also even goes, if you look in verse 9, do not grumble against one another, and brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. We'll talk a little bit more about this idea of grumbling a little bit later this morning. But this idea that it is the end of all things is at hand, or the coming of God is at hand. What did this mean to them at this particular time? What does it mean to us now, 2,000 years later? Is it still at hand? Yep, sir. Okay, it's at hand because we're not promised tomorrow. Kevin?
There's no more revelation.
Okay. this is the last time. There will not be another sort of revelation that will happen. God's plan has been fulfilled. And all that is left is God's patience to finally run out and the second coming to happen. And so we are living at that particular time. It is at hand, but for God, we look at it and we just... We don't understand time, or we don't see time in the way in which God does. We see this as at hand should be tomorrow. Well, we don't understand that same concept. We don't understand eternity the way in which God can. Larry?
Another verse is
Right. Yeah, I think as Larry was pointing out, the AD 70 doctrine, those people who saw this imminent Christ's return was happening when the destruction of Jerusalem, and I think we've discussed previous to that that this idea of at hand, we are in that sort of final phase of God's judgment. The redemption plan is complete, and that's when we're living now, is that end of times. Larry? Any other thoughts or comments? Yeah, Jimmy?
Just one other thing. I like what Sarah said about, you know, not knowing what tomorrow holds. You know, there's a real danger for us if we don't see, you know, if we go back and realize that God still, he's judging the living. That's us.
Right.
Those who continue to live, he's judging us. He's judging us daily. And so there is a tendency if we don't look at God as
yes.
Across daily. It is recognizing that he is very much near, and we don't know when that end is, but it's nearer
right.
than we think it
That's
is.
Right. That's right.
So there's a different mindset in which you live. I think if you get up every day living, this could be my last day, it really shapes
right.
your life differently than if you look at it and go, oh.
I got plenty of time.
I'm young, and who knows? Generation after generation has passed. Every generation needs to recognize that God is very near, and that
right.
the
right.
end could be.
That's right. That's right. And again, to fall into that, the second half of verse 7, the reason why, if the kingdom is at hand, or the return, let me restate that, the return of Christ is at hand, you need to be serious. You need to be sober-minded. You need to be watchful in your prayers. And so if you are living that way daily, understanding what Christ had suffered for you, understanding that you are under this tribulation, don't give up. The end might be coming for you, but that gift that you have, that eternal rest is there waiting for you as long as you don't give up. And that you need to be watchful, you need to be mindful, and you need to be sober-minded. And he reminded them of this. He uses the word sober-minded instead in the first chapter in verse 13. But we need to be serious. And we need to be serious in our prayer. And being watchful, as he says in verse 7. And above all of those things, he tells us that we need to have fervent love for one another. And I think this is something that, you know, the love that we have for one another, that's how people are going to see us as disciples of Christ. And it's used in other places where we see that the love will cover a multitude of sins. And so we are seeing ways in which he is telling us that fervent love that we have, that concern for our brother, that's the way we need to be living. And in doing so, we need to be hospitable with one another without grumbling. And I've got a couple of comments about that. But Matt, before I move forward. Good point. Other thoughts or comments? So as we show that love for one another, one of those ways is that we can be hospitable to one another. And how is it that we can be hospitable but grumble about it? Sarah? Okay. All right. Yep. What else? How else can we grumble about being hospitable? Larry?
Why don't
Why does it always fall on me, right? What other way?
Sometimes we're, you know, we look at someone and go, why do they continue to demos with hell?
That's right.
We think of it just having people in our home, and clearly that's not the
sure.
entire definition of being hospitable to someone else. But I think there's a tendency for us to grumble when, you know, we're having to go through that effort, and sometimes there's people that need our hospitality
right.
on a pretty frequent basis.
Yeah.
That, you know, our patience runs out. We need to recognize that we're all in this together, and that you look back to those first century Christians, they understood what they were going through really forced them to bond together.
Uh-huh.
I mean, let's face it, the way we live today in our neighborhoods, you know, we live such compartmentalized
right.
lives, right? You know, how well do we know our neighbors?
Right.
The guy
right.
next door to our neighborhood. You know, it's a different time.
And yeah.
So we need, especially those of the household of faith, we need
mm-hmm.
to be looking
mm-hmm.
out for each other. We need to be always hospitable to each other.
Sure.
Without the grumbling. That,
right.
That
right. Larry?
Two things you might want to comment. You know, one, what's the motive of real? What's the genuine motive, proper motive for hospitality? And two, we're about to go through an elder deacon study process, consider appointing them. That impacts that process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure. Sure. Sarah? You think about it, this particular time, I mean, there were probably some large disparity between those people who had perhaps a certain amount of wealth and those who did not. And perhaps that hospitality, that caretaking maybe fell on certain people. And that attitude, I think someone mentioned, that why does it fall on me all the time? Well, maybe it's because God's blessed you a little bit differently than somebody else. And so to be able to take that understanding and say, and we're going to talk about these gifts here in a minute, the gifts here don't always have to mean that I had some miraculous gift. There could be other blessings that you have and that you now need to be able to be hospitable. And hospitable in a way that you don't do it in a grumbly manner or a way in which you are, got to do this again. How about it's more about the fact that how much God has blessed me physically on this life. He's blessed everyone spiritually. And we have those blessings through there. But some of us perhaps have more either through our family, through other ways, things that, again, we need to be good stewards and understanding that that's not coming from us. Tim, and then.
Thinking about Christ and how he was hospitable, there's so many times where the crowds around him, and don't you know, he was tired and exhausted. But his attitude was always, my purpose
right.
is right here.
Right.
I'm about these people. There are also times where he needed to go recharge. And
right.
his recharge time was quiet time. He'd go off
right.
the mountain, he'd pray, and that's how he would build himself back up. He would lean on God, and then he'd go back into that multitude setting. And so
right.
I think that's important for us to know what charges us, what gets us built back up again,
mm-hmm.
and to do that so that we can go back and do the work.
Yeah, sure. That's right. Right.
But also, you know, if you're grumbling aloud to someone, think about how low you may be bringing that person
right.
and affecting them. I used to work in an office where there was one in our office that was next to us. And you would see these times where everything was peaceful and quiet, and then you had one person in the mix to get upset. And when they started talking, the whole pot was stirred and everybody was upset.
Right. That's right. That's right. Good point. Yeah.
Just thinking, you know, there are certain markers out there that let us know. Call somebody else.
No, go ahead. right behind you afterwards.
anyway, there are markers out there. When Paul challenges Corinthians and he says, don't be conformed, but be transformed. Anytime we want to sort of get an idea of how that transformation is coming along, we can look at things like this. We can look at how's our fervent love for the
right.
brethren. Like the world, we have fervent love for those that fall in our same, you know, classification, or those who are
right.
like us, or those people that we like. And for everybody else, we're just sort of like casual. Well, yeah, I'll put up with you. Don't like you very much. And there's a fervent love is fervent love.
Right.
You know, and it's
right.
Like so whether it's that fervent love or it's that hospitality, if we want to really look at those markers of transformation. These are those. You know, we look at those and find out. Does that describe us?
Right.
If it doesn't. And that transformation, although it's never quite complete till we're done,
sure,
it's got some more work that needs to be done.
That's right. That's right.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say that love boils down to love for your fellow man, and you want to do it because you love them, and it has nothing to do with the preparation.
Right. Sure. Good point. Matt. This week is going to be. Right, right. Sure. Sure. Right. Right, right. Good point. And as we move forward here, and it says, as each one of you received a gift, minister one another as the stewards of the manifold grace of God. So what gifts is he talking about? I think there is a gift, certainly. So each one of us have received a gift. Bruce? That's right. That's right. Yeah.
I think it also means the gift that we have regarding grace.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be able and willing and very quick to give grace to our brethren, just like we expect to give grace. And when the verse goes on to say, the manifold grace, the much grace,
sure, sure. And again, this going on that idea of that gift being that grace that we have all been sort of bestowed with, as we minister one another, we have that concern, we have that care, we're going to minister to one another because we know how much we have been forgiven. But it also goes to the idea to be stewards of the manifold grace. When he says manifold, what does he mean by manifold? lot of grace. What does manifold also mean? Varied. Different. So everyone, while we've all been bestowed grace, the idea of the manifold grace is the many or the varied in terms of the amount of grace that we are all sort of given. And it varies from person to person. I mean, again, the sin, our sins are forgiven. It is, I'm not saying that you're doled out a different amount of grace from God. What I'm saying there, though, is the idea that it is this grace of God that is given, that the word manifold is just, it means many, it means varied. It's not just as they minister this gift to one another, we have to be good stewards and stewards of things, just like the five talent man, the one talent man. It's all different for each one of us. And so we have to make sure that as we're given that we're using it the right way. We're not hiding it. We're not keeping it to ourselves. And if we have been given more opportunity, more ways, because we can teach, because of our wisdom, because of the way in which we can recall certain things, aren't miraculous things, but there are different ways. We're all different people. We have different skill sets, and we need to be good stewards of those skill sets. And we need to be able to share those things with one another. Thoughts or comments? Sure.
That we each have obtained that grace from God. Here it's, I think, described as a special gift.
Right.
Certainly the apt way to put it. This idea of it being indescribable, isn't it just that?
Sure.
Think about what God has worked in all of us. He's taken us from various states of, you know, being away from Him, being enemies of His.
Sure.
To us being in a relationship where we can call Him our Father. You know, that is an indescribable gift.
Right.
It's something that should motivate us to share the special gift.
Sure. Other thoughts or comments? Yeah, Tim. That's right.
So I think about me and what we develop as Christians today. What's being described here is a really well-developed character. Mm-hmm. It's not just something that we'll wake up and say, okay, so I need to go recon everyone.
Right.
Check out all this.
Right.
It's just something that we are. That's who we are. And then when you develop that character, that's when other people can see us and say, whatever that is, I want to be a part of it.
Right, right. Good point. Other thoughts or comments? So if anyone ministers, he goes back to say here that let him do it as with the ability which God supplies. Again, we're seeing that even if we have a speaking ability, we have the courage to stand before people, we have the courage to be one-on-one and talk with someone. What we have, that ability that we have, is supplied by God. And in all these things that God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. And so we might have been blessed with the ability to do that. We might have been blessed to be a song leader. We might have been blessed to be a teacher. Those gifts, those things that we have, they're from God. They are supplied from God. And we're going to do that through the glory to glory Jesus Christ. Not ourselves, not to pat ourselves on the back, not to separate ourselves from someone else, but we need to make sure we are doing that. One, that we speak, let him speak as the oracles of God. So there's some concern there that as we speak, we need to know that we are speaking for God, and what we speak needs to be what God wants us to speak. But these things, the gifts that we have, the ability that we have, it is supplied by God, and we should be remembering that. And it says that God may be glorified, to him belong the glory and the dominion forever and ever. Thoughts or comments? And then he goes into the section of these trials. He's talked before about trials, and now he's going to kind of take it a little bit further and talk about these fiery trials. Do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you. So there's a reason why these trials are there, and then whether the trial, fiery trial, is to describe the intensity of it. But it's there to try you. And don't think it's strange that this is going to happen to you. In fact, if you follow after Jesus, it is something that is going to happen to you, is what we see in other places within the New Testament. But rejoice to the extent that you can partake in Christ's suffering, that when his glory is revealed, you may be glad with exceeding joy. So there's this idea that as they suffer through these trials, to rejoice in that. I think of Peter being in jail, and then, you know, instead of being downtrodden about it, I mean, what are they doing? They're singing. They're finding ways in which you can teach other people in the context in which you're in. And then the Philippian jailer being able to listen in on that. And so in whatever you're doing, you know, that opportunity there and how you live your life, other people are going to see that. So even when you're under trials, even when you are in those fiery trials, we should be rejoicing. We should find a way in which if we're going to rejoice because of what Christ has done for us and the suffering in the flesh that he did, we should find rejoicing that we have, that not think that it's strange, but it is going to happen to us, and we should be rejoicing in that. It says, and if you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you. So I don't think what we understand is that, you know, if you're going to begin to talk about being, you know, not, if you're going to suffer because of your own sin, because you're a murderer or a thief, don't rejoice in that. Don't take satisfaction in the fact that you're suffering because of your own sin. What he is saying, though, is take satisfaction, you should have that idea that if you're going to suffer for Christ's sake, that's something that should be joyous. That's something that is blessed. But don't feel reproach or don't feel ashamed because of this reproach that they're bringing upon you. Because I think there might have been some, you know, they were put in jail. And how does their family feel? They have a family member now in jail. What they're telling them is, you know, don't feel that reproach. Don't feel ashamed of that. If you are suffering for Christ's sake, you should rejoice in that. Larry?
It's interesting the other translations of verse 12 really give emphasis instead of trying, it talks about your test.
Mm-hmm.
And so a couple of questions that I've come up with. Did every Christian go through such testing? Secondly, What is the testing? What actually does God want to bring out of that?
Other translations there? For your testing. Right. And again, I think we see other verses within the New Testament that these trials, they are to test you. I mean, that's what they're there for. But what's the result of that testing? To build their faith, right?
Yeah, Larry. But some Christians may have blended in with the world, and guess what?
No testing. That's right. That's right. And again, what he's talking about here, those who are going to suffer as Christians, let them not be ashamed. I think that becomes the trial for us today. Not that we're being put in jail, but are we hiding away when perhaps something that the world is pushing before us and we don't want to speak what we feel is right. We'd rather just hide with the world and just agree with it perhaps, maybe not speak that we are agreeing with that, but we're not willing to sort of stand out there and be different. Because we're ashamed. Are we ashamed to stand up and say, that is wrong? I feel that for me and my house, this is the way that we need to live. Are we going to be ashamed? And so these are people here at this time that were standing up for what is right, and they were physically suffering trials because of that. But as Larry sort of pointed out, maybe they didn't. Maybe they decided to sort of go with the flow. They would maybe attend on Sunday, but then during the week, they were just like every other Gentile. Trials didn't really come on them. They didn't suffer. Kevin? Okay.
It's going to happen.
That's right. Right.
Next thing is when you're training for any type of physical event, you got to go through pain to get to your goal.
Right.
But once you've completed that goal, the pain is you rejoice because you overcame.
That's right.
And you finish the goal. And that's kind of the same thing here. That we can have joy at the end because we overcame those sufferings.
That's right. Good point. Larry? That's right. That's right. Exactly. Good point. Good point. Any other thoughts or comments? Yeah, Ms. Belinda?
As parents, if we think that we can grow our children and protect them by trying to smooth out every little problem or every little moment of trial for them, that removes some chances for them to get stronger and to, you know, as they develop, from small children to older.
Right, right, right,
right.
Right. Make the decision. That's right. They need to learn. Thank you for your comments this morning. We'll pick up at the end of this. We'll start chapter 5, Lord willing, next week.